can go ahead.
All right. Again, good morning. We're now ready to proceed in the second matter scheduled for oral argument today, State of Minnesota versus Michaela Joy Fredenberg. Counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and it's important that you each state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are making an audio recording. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Joseph McInnes. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent Michaela Fredenberg. At the outset of Ms. Fredenberg's trial, the prosecutor had a problem. He realized that he lacked evidence of Ms. Fredenberg's operation of a vehicle and possession of physical possession of that vehicle. How he chose to deal with that lack of evidence by admitting inadmissible testimonial evidence in the form of Exhibit 6 and committing pervasive prosecutorial misconduct requires that this court reverse Ms. Fredenberg's conviction and grant her a new trial. Now, I'd like to discuss those two issues this morning, the inadmissible testimonial hearsay evidence that was admitted in the form of Exhibit 6 and the prosecutorial misconduct that took place.
Do you agree that the as to your Confrontation Clause argument and your hearsay argument, that if the evidence is admissible for something other than the truth of the matter asserted, that that would defeat both of those arguments?
I think if it met a hearsay exception and was non-testimonial, then it would.
It would dispose of both arguments.
Correct, yes.
So wasn't the evidence offered not for the truth of the matter asserted, but for the basis of the officer's belief that there was probable cause?
Well, I think this question is getting to the root of the problem in this case, is that the prosecutor stated to the court that his intent was to admit this evidence to prove the officer's belief.
And when you talk about this evidence, we're talking about the initial statement that the neighbor made to the investigating officer,
well,
not the recorded one.
Well, the prosecutor did not distinguish, in the motions in limine, he portrayed the statements of Ms. Sutter as if it were a spontaneous, excited utterance. So,
well, the argument wasn't that it was. I didn't see that in the record that the prosecutor said this is admissible because it's an excited utterance.
He did not. He said it's admissible because it goes to officer beliefs. But of course, State v. Coppi says that officer beliefs are not admissible for that purpose. Coppi says that officer beliefs are not the focus when we're looking at probable cause in the context of a test refusal violation.
Well, so, doesn't Coppi say that you look at the totality of the circumstances to see whether they would lead a reasonable officer to think there was probable cause?
Well, I think it says. I mean, it specifically says that the subjective beliefs of the officers are not the focus, and instead we look at the totality of the circumstances
to figure out what an objective officer would believe.
Exactly.
But that includes a statement from a witness.
Yes, and Coppi says that, the jig requires that the state present that as evidence, that the state meet the rules of evidence and present the prove the totality of the circumstances, so that the jury can then assess whether it's a reasonable officer.
Right.
Would.
So I didn't understand. I mean, so I looked at, I watched the entire, what you call an interview of the witness. I mean, there was 2 minutes from the time the officer began asking substantive questions and finished. And those questions were, what was she wearing? Just to confirm, she was driving fast down the road, and then she ran straight between the townhouses. Did you see her hair? And do you remember the color of her clothing? Those were that was the extent of the interview. What I'm trying to see how that information and the responses to those questions are at all problematic.
Well, I think the fact that they are out-of-court statements, that this is a testimonial interview that's occurring after Ms. Riedenburg is in custody, and there's no exigency whatsoever.
But if they're being offered for something other than the truth of the matter asserted, if they're being offered to establish the officer's knowledge of probable cause to arrest her, to ask her consent, ask her to submit to a breath test.
But that would again be the subjective knowledge of Officer Ash.
An objective officer in Officer Ash's shoes is what we're looking at.
Correct. I mean,
so an objective officer asking those questions, getting the information about what she was wearing and the color of her hair, what color was her clothing, doesn't that go to probable cause?
Those questions are proving the truth of the matter asserted and going to probable cause.
Right, so, both. And so if it's admissible for one purpose, the fact that it's not admissible for the other doesn't prevent its admission.
I would disagree, Your Honor, respectfully.
Okay.
Those are facts. The officer in that moment is eliciting facts that are being relied upon for probable cause. So those statements are for the truth of the matter asserted. Probable cause is not...
No, they're for the officer gaining knowledge.
The officer gaining knowledge...
Whether or not those statements were true, whether or not the responses were true, what matters is that the officer heard those things and formed a basis for probable cause to ask for your client to submit to a breath test.
Well, that would be, and if we were looking at subjectively, if we're looking at the old jig, which questioned, does the officer believe that they have probable cause?
Well, would a reasonable officer in this officer's shoes, gaining the knowledge that this officer received by asking the questions that this officer asked, does that establish probable cause from a legal standpoint, from an objective officer standpoint? Well, isn't that what the inquiry is about?
I think the inquiry, in my view, is that the current jig supports this as well, and COPPI does as well, is that it requires that the officer come in and testify to the facts and circumstances that I pulled the car over, I saw the driving conduct or whatever it is.
I heard from such and such a witness that.
But I think you need, if you're relying on those facts. So these are facts that are being brought out, that are being put before the jury, that the jury is going to rely on for their factual determination about the reasonableness. So those need to comply with the rules of evidence and confrontation clause. So if there's reliance on the information Ms. Sutter gave, Ms. Sutter and the truth of what she asserted, which is what they're relying on, then she needs to come to court and be subject to cross-examination and testify to those facts.
I think we have a disagreement about that premise that you're asserting right now. My understanding is if the officer received information from an informant that such and such was the case, and that information was reliable, for probable cause, there's no confrontation clause issue or hearsay issue in that regard, because it's not it doesn't matter whether it actually happened. What matters is whether there's a basis for the officer to believe that that happened in order to establish probable cause, an objectively reasonable officer receiving that information. If I'm wrong about that, I'd like to, maybe you can identify a case that, that supports that view.
Well, I mean, I think State v. Coppi clearly delineates that, that the beliefs of the officers are not the focus. So the, I think that removes that. I think it's slipping into a subjective standard. So there's, it's
why can't we look at the information the officer elicited from an objective standpoint?
I think in, the focus is on not necessarily, you know, what these officers did or didn't know or did or didn't believe in that moment. The focus is what is the totality of the facts, and would a reasonable officer presented with those facts make an arrest?
Let's assume you're correct. For the purpose of my next question, let's assume you're correct that this was error. Why isn't it harmless error, given that the police officers knew that Ms. Vredenburg was the subject of reports that she was causing a disturbance, that they encountered her previously, that they noticed that she was impaired when they encountered her previously, that she declined a ride home because they recognized she was too impaired to drive, that she walked away, that she was called, that they were called back because she was back there banging her head against the door of her ex-boyfriend's apartment, that she left the area driving a particular Ford vehicle, that they pursued the car, that the car evaded her, they found the car, and they found her near the car with the car keys. Why isn't that sufficient, without regard to any other statements of probable cause, that she was driving the car impaired, sufficient to ask her to submit to a breath test?
I think if you look at the testimony of Officer Ash, she was facing north, I believe it was 31st Avenue, and she sees a black Ford pass her and, you know, go, you know, it was a block away, and she started following it. And so we don't have any indication, you know, we have basically Officer Ash, you know, seeing a car that matched the description. She loses sight of it. She it turns left to go north on 31st Avenue, which is a bigger street, and then she assumes it turned back into the subdivision, but she doesn't see it. She herself.
It's okay. She finds the car.
She eventually finds a black car. It's, she doesn't make the determination. There's nothing in the record that she says, you know, I got up close to the car that I was following and I saw the license plate and it was Ms. Vredenburg's car.
This is just probable cause. She sees the same car. She sees a car of the same type.
Correct.
And then.
And there's no indication that that car, at that point, she's not touching the hood and feeling that it's warm. She's not, Officer Ash is not.
No, I know all the things it's not. Why isn't what we know probable cause?
Well, and then Ms. Vredenburg is, it's hard to tell from the map, but it looks Exhibit 1. She's stopped quite a distance away. It looks like several hundred yards away.
With the key to the car.
Correct.
On her person.
Correct.
So why wouldn't a reasonable police officer believe from that, well, there's probable cause to believe that she was the driver of the car, since she's the one who has the keys to the car, since she's the one who was in the area causing the disturbance and left in the car. Why wouldn't that be enough for probable cause?
Well, there's no indication that she left in the car. There's Officer Ash seeing a car that fit the same description. But in these circumstances, I think that if we take out Ms. Sutter's Exhibit 6, her statement, then we have a totally different situation going to the jury.
I've just described to you the circumstances apart from her statement. Why aren't these circumstances sufficient for probable cause? We're not talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
Or even proof by preponderance of the evidence.
Correct.
Just probable cause.
And
a low standard, we're told by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Correct. And Your Honor, I understand it's a low standard, but at the time she stopped, she's several hundred yards away from where the car is found. It's approximately It's about 15, almost 20 minutes later. I believe the car is found at 12:50, and she's stopped around 1:05. So it's maybe about 15 minutes later.
With the keys to a vehicle that's registered to her. I mean, my question, it seems like you're trying to conflate proof required to support the DWI charge, for example, versus what's needed to prove test refusal, which doesn't require proof of the underlying facts, if you will.
And I understand that, and I see my time is expiring.
Please do.
I think that there's substantial prejudice to Ms. Vredenburgh here, because her jury trial would look completely different if all the evidence is, you know, she's in this area, she's walking around, Officer Ash saw her driving, and she stopped, you know, 15 minutes later, several hundred yards away. She does have the keys at that point, but she's several hundred yards away from the car. So I think that her trial is completely different, and the closing arguments of counsel are completely different. And I think it's a it turns an otherwise strong case into a case that's very borderline. And I think that's where the prejudice is.
All right. Can I ask one follow-up question, though? You're
out
of time. Could you give one more crack at my question? Without going over all the facts, just a simple statement. Why isn't probable cause established without the statement, given the description of facts that I've outlined?
She's not located by the car. She's located 150 yards away, whatever it is, from the area where Officer Ash finds the car. Other than Officer Ash's, claim to have, other than Officer Ash seeing a car that was similar, we don't have any indication of her recent driving of the car. She's not in physical possession because the car is several hundred yards away, and we don't have evidence of recent operation.
Okay. I think I understand
Thank you,
your
Counsel.
Answer.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state in this matter. I'd like to start my remarks with a hypothetical example. I'll strive to keep it within the contours of our case so as to avoid any accusations of prosecutorial misconduct with respect to hypotheticals. Instead of this Ford car stopping across the street from Ms. Sutter's home, let's say that the car pulled into a nearby Quick Trip parking lot just around the corner from Mr. Schaefer's home where there had been the previous disturbance. In fresh pursuit, Officer Ash pulls into the Quick Trip and sees this car that she believes was she was following parked in front of the store with no one inside, and she sees Ms. Sutter filling her car with gas a few feet away. And a similar encounter occurs there instead of by the home in the Quick Trip parking lot where Ms. Sutter, the exchange was, did you see the woman driving the car? And Ms. Sutter says effectively, she ran that away. We plug in then the remaining facts that we have in the outcome here where Ms. Vredenburgh refuses testing. She hires her trial counsel, Austin Swisher, who a few days later goes to Quick Trip and obtains the surveillance footage from the parking lot, which is very good quality and very clear. And it seriously calls into question whether she was the driver of the car. Better yet, it conclusively shows that Ms. Vredenburgh is not the driver of the car. The question of our law school examination on hearsay here, it would be, is that video relevant in her trial for test refusal? I say to you, the answer is no. It's not relevant, because whether or not Ms. Vredenburg drove the car is not an element of this offense.
And why was the state interested in getting Ms. Sutter, is it Sutter or Sutton, I'm not sure, the witness's statement and video into evidence?
Because it is part of the totality of the circumstances determination for probable cause.
So it is relevant. So the video would also be relevant.
Well, so I would say it meets the initial threshold of, I said admissible. It's relevant in the sense that it relates to the case, but whatever probative value it might have would be substantially outweighed by the risk that the jury would be confused by this notion that of defense of, say, actual driving.
You weren't the prosecutor yourself, correct?
Correct. Mike Walters was the prosecutor
so
in this case.
So doesn't the prosecutor's statement to the jury about the witness's statement demonstrate that the state was treating the statement not merely as evidence of what police were informed in order to establish probable cause, but also that it was being offered for the truth of the matter asserted? Now, quote here from the prosecutor, quote, "We also know, we know from eyewitness testimony that she was driving. Ms. Sutter saw a woman matching Ms. Vredenburg's description. Now, I grant you, she admitted that it happened really fast, boom, 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 was her quote, and she couldn't say what color Ms. Friedenberg's hair was, and she could only take a guess at what color her clothes were, and she certainly didn't know Ms. Friedenberg's name. But nonetheless, she described a tall young woman. That's Ms. Friedenberg to a T." So, I mean, there are problems with that because there are misstatements there because that wasn't an accurate description of the testimony. But beside that, doesn't that indicate to you that it was at least argued to the jury that this was for the truth of the matter asserted, not merely for probable cause?
Well, I think it would have been better phrased to say, and when you are deliberating on the element of probable cause, there was an identified citizen complainant, Diane Sutter, who provided the following statements.
That would not only be better, that would be accurate.
That would be accurate.
But doesn't this appear to you to be a statement that the jury should accept the eyewitness's testimony for the truth of the matter asserted?
I think that's a fair statement to say that it suggests that to the jury. Now, that's been raised a couple of different ways, but as to the question, the first element, the issue we're dealing with here is a hearsay objection. And so in that context, I think Mr. Walter was quite clear in this discussion that this was not offered for its truth per se. It was offered to meet this element of probable cause.
When it was offered?
Yes.
But not when it was argued?
I guess the court can read it for itself. You know, I think.
Well, I'm asking you. I mean, it's the only way to read it, isn't it? Can it be read any other way?
It certainly draws that suggestion. I don't disagree with the court on that. But that's a different, that may relate to a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. It doesn't relate, though, to the evidentiary question.
That is one of the claims of prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes, and so to that end, we've argued about that. It was unobjected to at the time, so I would urge a modified plain error analysis as to that. And we've discussed that. In light of all the other evidence in that, I don't think it rises to the level of reversible error. Moreover, I think it's a careless statement. I mean, it's not well framed, but she is an eyewitness. Not only that, they saw exactly what she said. It's all captured on body camera video. We know precisely what it was she said, where she said it, to whom. So there's no mischaracterization, really.
There's a mischaracterization as to how the jury should be using it.
Well, if any
proper thing to say would be is, you know, you cannot consider this for the truth of the matter. It's only offered for this limited purpose, which is the officer's knowledge.
Well, let me frame it a different way. Effectively, Mr. Walters was raising the bar for himself. The state didn't have to prove that she actually drove, and if to the extent that Mr. Walters wanted to, you know, assume a higher threshold, I don't know that that's harmful or prejudicial.
Well, it'd be confusing, wouldn't it, to the jury?
perhaps, but not unfairly or prejudicially.
Let me ask you another. The thing that jumped to me was, and maybe you can answer this, what legitimate purpose did the reference to the magic loophole serve in the prosecutor's rebuttal argument other than disparaging the defense?
Well, in this case, there was no, there was a waiver of the issue of right to counsel. There was no claim that the refusal was reasonable. At best, the defense arguments say that this on its face isn't a refusal. I mean, perhaps an overly colorful choice of words, but the notion is that that somehow refusal is a safe harbor. We see that term frequently in the case law dealing with refusal. That it's not a safe harbor, it's not an excuse to put conditions upon the demand. Will you take a test? Well, I will on the following conditions. It's not a defense. It's not a loophole. And again, this is a rebuttal argument. The prosecutor is responding, you know, on a short hop to an argument that's presented that wasn't really raised below, that somehow this is actually a defense. And you know, kind of bleeds into the anecdote that he used about his child, where he's saying, you know, I want you to do your homework. Well, I'll do my homework if I get candy. And he used that as an analogy to try to explain the law of refusal, that the driver has a duty to take the test. Or, you know, it's not a safe harbor. And the driver cannot place conditions upon that. There are arguments about, as the court knows, whether the right to counsel is vindicated, whether the refusal was reasonable. Those were not raised, and those weren't elements here. So I think that Mr. Walters, and could he have been more articulate, perhaps, but was trying to frame this as, he used the term magic loophole, but it's not a legal loophole to place these conditions upon the demand, and I think that's what he's trying to suggest. Could he have said it more articulately? Perhaps, but again, I do not believe this rises to any level of reversible error. So, the history of this jury instruction for refusal is of interest, and it relates to the copy case. But when you look back to this case of Olmscheid in 1992, it's cited in our brief, it noted that the pattern instruction at that time did not include probable cause. It was just that the defendant was requested by a peace officer to submit to a chemical test and refused the test. And in Olmscheid, the trial court granted the defendant's request to add an additional element to the offense, to add probable cause. I think the defendant wanted proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The trial court ended up with probable cause, and it sort of stuck after Olmscheid, and the jury instructions have been modified since. The copy case, in that case, the fact pattern was that the driver was observed by a police officer speeding and was pulled over, and the officer observed the telltale signs of bloodshot, watery eyes, and a slight odor of alcohol, and it led to a DUI arrest. Copy has nothing to do with actual driving or who the driver was. What it had to do with was the officer's assessment of impairment, probable cause for impairment. And the issue in copy was the jury instructions itself. And the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at that and found three flaws in the instruction at that time, because it didn't require the officer to recite actual observations and circumstances supporting a finding of probable cause. And again, probable cause here as to impairment.
Well, we're talking about probable cause. If the officers already had probable cause that Ms. Friedenberg was engaged in impaired driving at the time that they took her, that they detained her before asking questions of the witness further when she was in her garage, why did the officer ask the neighbor of description of the driver?
So if the question is, if collectively, under the collective team theory, other officers had probable cause at the time Ash was talking to Sutter, Why did she continue to ask questions? Is that the...
Yeah, what's the point of asking for a description if probable cause already existed?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think that Officer Ash was acting independently on her own aspect. She's gathering information. You don't know till you ask. You know, again, they're gathering evidence. They're asking questions. That all flows into this totality. I don't know what Officer Ash knew or didn't know about the other officers had.
When I think it was Officer Christensen that was with Ms. Friedenberg at
later
consent. Ms. Friedenberg was claiming, "Well, I wasn't even driving." And do you remember Officer Christensen's response was, "Well, yeah, we know you were driving because the witness said you were." Not, we know you were driving because we followed the car. Not the list of things that I posed to Ms. Friedenberg's counsel. So doesn't that suggest that the statement was necessary for probable cause? This is regarding your harmless error argument.
So maybe stated another way, if the court were to suppress the statements of Ms. Sutter, would the record be sufficient to convict? Well, I think it would. The court went through most of those facts. I don't need to reiterate all of them, but you know, the police knew who they were dealing with. This Ms. Friedenberg, there was a connection with Mr. Schaefer there. They knew she was visibly intoxicated. They were called twice out there. They knew the vehicle was registered to Ms. Friedenberg, and that was confirmed by the key in her pocket. She was arrested in the vicinity nearby. After the second time they'd come out to see
her. But why shouldn't we be concerned with the officer's explanation to Ms. Friedenberg when she asked, well, how do you know I was driving? How do you know it was me? How do you know I was driving? And well, because we've got this witness who says you were.
Well, there was communication. You can see on the video, Officer Ash was communicating information to the other officers, and whether that got, you know, I don't know how clearly that was conveyed. Moreover, as you know, there's nothing wrong with investigators and officers suggesting things to suspects to make them say things. Well, you know, your buddy already confessed. He already implicated you in this crime. You might as well come clean with me right now. I mean, that's perfectly permissible, and who knows? She might say, okay, I was driving.
Can I ask you one question about the misconduct allegations? There are several, but the one question I have is the statement to the jury regarding whether the implied consent advisory had been properly presented. But I assure you, he read it correctly. Why isn't that vouching for the truth of a fact?
Well, again, it's unobjected to, so we reviewed under modified plain error.
Sure.
The jury not only heard the testimony, but the advisory itself was in the record, as was a recording of him reading it. So there was three forms of evidence.
Well, I understand that. So your point is that he was right when he said that he read it correctly, but the problem that I think is being asserted at an appeal is the statement, but I, prosecutor, assure you, jury, of this fact.
Yeah,
That's problematic, isn't it?
Well, I would probably concede it's not the right way to phrase that. I just don't think it gives rise to reversible error. It's an inarticulate statement.
You agree that it's improper, but your argument is that it's harmless.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McInnes, you will have the last word.
Let me just respond to counsel statements regarding Olmscheid and where these elements come from. So the probable cause element is not coming from, you know, just the ether or case law. It's coming from the statute, and the statute requires that, and it's 169A.51. It requires that the officer have probable cause.
And you agree that the jury was properly instructed in this case?
Yes, I do agree. Yes. And they did receive the correct instruction. And just to return, I don't believe probable cause exists outside of truth of the matter asserted. So the proof that's
outside of the statement by the witness.
Correct. So evidence introduced to prove probable cause is proving the truth of the matter asserted by the statement, because that's what has to be proved. And I think that that is what Coppi says, is that we're, you know, with this objective standard, you know, we're not going to say that, you know, I mean, there's plenty of, you know, we could say the police report, why don't we just hand this in because it lists out the officer's reasons for probable cause. And if probable cause is non-hearsay, then the police report should be non-hearsay. But that's not what
Well, the police report is what the police are saying. The probable cause is based upon what police have observed, either by hearing it from witnesses, by watching it with their eyes. That's what the officer relies upon for our objective basis to determine whether probable cause exists. Whether it comes from an interview of a witness, whether it comes from a witness spontaneously making a statement, making a call to police for a report, or an officer observing certain conduct. I think all of that goes into the calculus that we put into the objective officer's perspective when we decide probable cause.
Well, and I would say that hopefully I'm not hair splitting, but I would say that those facts, so the totality of the facts have to be proven, and it doesn't really matter what Officer Ash believed or didn't believe, or what information she had or didn't have. What matters are...
Well, I think there's two different things there. What she believed doesn't matter. The information she had does matter, because it informs us what an objective officer would have then surmised from the circumstances. I think that's how the objective test works.
Okay.
You correct me if you have a different perspective, I think.
My perspective on this case would be that if we are going to apply that objective standard to these facts, we need to prove these facts to the jury through the with the rules of evidence.
We need to prove that she was driving?
No, we need to prove the statement that Ms. Sutter is making needs to be presented to the jury through the rules of evidence and subject to cross-examination.
So an officer says, I received a call from my dispatcher that there was a reckless driver in the area. Your view would be that would be inadmissible to establish the officer's probable cause. We have to actually have chase back the evidence to figure out, well, where did that come from? It's hearsay from the dispatcher who heard it from a reporter. So you need to actually get the caller in, I gather, is what you're saying, in order to establish probable cause.
Well, I think, you know, if we had like a 911 call, then that 911 call would be presented to the jury as the basis for probable cause.
Okay. So how is that 911 call differ from a statement from a witness?
Because it's non-testimonial, and because it meets the rules of evidence. So it meets a hearsay exception and is non-testimonial.
But the 911 call doesn't?
No. I'm saying that the 911 call would meet those evidentiary standards.
How would the 911 call of a report on a phone to the dispatcher meet the evidentiary standard, but a witness telling an officer face to face the same information does not?
Because it's hearsay and it's testimonial. Because there's no hearsay exception that applies to it, and it's testimonial. It's after she's been placed into custody. There's no exigency whatsoever, and it's describing past events. And I see my time has expired. I would ask that this court reverse Ms. Frindberg's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful briefing and argument. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. That is the last case scheduled for oral argument, so we are in recess.
All rise.